Welcome to session 211, the depiction of women in Mormon popular culture. We want to welcome you all out. Just a few reminders, if your cell phone ringer is on, please turn it off. Anything else that might be noisy, please be prepared to silence it if you have something that might be too noisy. I'm supposed to remind you to buy some books. And Sunstone earns a percentage of benchmark book sales at the symposium, so please visit the book vendor's room often. And we are recording the session, so we need to have you all remember when you're speaking to be close to the mic. And if you come up to ask a question, you need to come to the mic there. And I will introduce the speakers. The first speaker will be Micah Nicolaisen. Right? Okay. He's a wedding and portrait photographer residing in Chandler, Arizona. He's an avid consumer of Mormon studies and has participated for several years in the online Mormon community as a blogger and podcaster. He's interested in helping individuals navigate faith transitions and building community outside of traditional religious institutions and cultures. Second speaker will be Lori Berkman. She grew up in a very liberal-believing LDS family in the Pacific Northwest and currently resides near Seattle. She stepped out of correlation just over a year ago and has really enjoyed the growth that has come as a result. She served a mission in Argentina, graduated from BYU in 06, and has worked professionally as a web designer, technical writer, and editor. She currently takes care of her three young children full-time and is a permablogger at Rational Faiths. The third speaker will be Audrey Dutcher. She's been a media journalist for over a decade. She has a Bachelor's of Arts in English from the University of Utah, worked as a acute speech translator for the deaf, a television reporter, an advertising director, account director, a professional model, screenwriter, film critic for 6 years, during which she became one of the founding members of the Utah Film Critics Association and its only female member at that time. She's been published in national and international publications, including Newsweek, Los Angeles Daily News, and The Friend, appeared on syndicated network television programs, including the Dr. Lara television show and AutoNet TV, and interviewed dozens of celebrities in her capacity as an on-camera film critic, aside from her print journalism obligations. She's currently producing a screenplay with Richard Dutcher that she describes as a Mormon modern adaptation of a feminist classic, Kate Chopin's Awakening, entitled She's Not Herself. She has two children and lives with Dutcher in Central Salt Lake City. And the final speaker will be Richard Dutcher, a writer and filmmaker. His work involves the movies God's Army, Brigham City, States of Grace, Falling, and Evil Angel. His next directorial project is in development. She's Not Herself, a feminist Mormon film written by Audrey Bach. And I'll turn it over.
Should I go up there?
If you're more comfortable, I think either one's okay.
Okay. Oh, I'll go.
You're going to set the precedent
now. Yeah, okay.
Good morning, everybody.
Good morning.
I'm the reason we're starting late, so I apologize for that. So, also, I'm the rank amateur here. I have zero educational or professional credentials that qualify me to really comment about this. But I am a Mormon man, and I'm married to a Mormon woman, and I have a daughter who will be a Mormon woman someday. So this topic definitely still has application directly in my personal life. Recently I rewatched the documentary Misrepresentation, which I'd recommend everybody watch. It's really about what we're talking about, but instead of exclusively applying it to Mormon popular culture, it really talks about how both men and women are sexualized in the media in the United States. And so it's interesting when you view a documentary like that and they point out how much the media sexualizes women. And we always hear the term that sex sells and things like that. And, you know, the way the female body is used to sell things like soda and, NFL games and things like that is focused on sort of the fantasization and the idealization of the female body to sexualize women. But as I was watching the documentary, I started to think how we do the opposite to accomplish the same end in Mormon culture through our modesty rhetoric. And This is something that I'm sure all of you are, you know far more about this than I do. But, you know, essentially, when I look at the way I see women portrayed in things like church media, the way that women, you know, are portrayed in church videos, and also, you know, we have to look at the way women are portrayed here in good old Zion. The way that the modesty rhetoric sexualizes women in the LDS media is something that I'd be interested to talk about a little bit more. Other than that, I don't really. I'm more interested to hear from my other panelists who are far more knowledgeable about this than I am. But that's sort of the angle that I'm interested in pursuing. So thank you all very much.
Good morning. My name is Lori Berkman. I'm from the Seattle area. I grew up in the Northwest. When I first saw I was asked to be on the panel, I inferred Mormon media rather than Mormon popular culture, and I stuck on that first. And then about 3 or 4 days ago, when I really wanted to hone in on what I wanted to talk about, I realized it was popular culture, and that was much more broad and kind of opened up. I'm 32, and I kind of wanted to talk about at different times in my life what popular culture and Mormonism meant to me and women's place in it. When you're younger and in primary, then it's pretty much only going to be the scripture stories that they're pulling from. And women's representation was more than lacking there. And as a young child, I remember, you know, you get to go up front and everybody gets to choose their part that they get to play. And the Book of Mormon has, let's see, I looked on LDS.org and it says there's 150 references to females. But there are 6 given by name, and only 2 of them are strictly from the Book of Mormon itself, and only one of them gets a real name, and that's Sariah, whom we all know. And I enjoyed the description here. This is from LDS.org that says, 2 women were wives of prophets. Both were closely tied to Nephi, yet one is comparatively a major Book of Mormon character, while the other remains anonymous. The first, Sariah, was the helpmate of the visionary Lehi and the mother of 8 or so sons and the daughters who were the roots of the extensive Nephite and Lamanite civilizations. But more meaningful to me than her role as a progenitress. Okay, I read that out loud before. But now I have it in front of a large group of people. Is the model that she represents of a woman growing in testimony of the Lord's purposes through a worrisome trial that strengthened her faith. Uncomplaining, who's human, that's in parentheses, and grieving for her unreturned son, Sariah was comforted by Lehi's language expressing his faith. After her family was reunited, she testified of her newfound surety that the Lord had told Lehi to flee into the wilderness, protected her sons, and given them power to accomplish his commands. The unnamed wife of the great leader Nephi comes across with a less clear profile. However, she does present a good example of a distraught woman turning to prayer when her husband's life was in danger. So those are our 2 Book of Mormon heroines to draw from for all of primary. And both of them are worried, and they're also described as the helpmate for their husband and the giver of, you know, progeny to the Nephite civilization, or in the other case, she was really worried about her husband and gave a really good example of a distraught woman. That's actually how she was described. And my mom is a physical therapist, and my father was a bus driver for the city buses in Portland. And my mom was much more educated than my father, and my last name was Ball growing up. And I always knew he wouldn't be Bishop just because Bishop Ball sounded stupid. And he was a bus driver, so I just didn't think that that fit the profile that had always been projected to me. But that was much less troublesome than my mom, who was incredibly intellectual and very, very smart. She has a hard time cutting loose, but my dad was really good at that. So anyway, it was really hard for me to find a place, first off, in the scriptures of primary or young women's, of anyone that I related to. And I was always very proud of my mom. She worked with handicapped kids, and I mean, the lives that she touched every day, in addition to raising five children, and we were a zany bunch, she did an excellent job at both things, and I never felt lacking. And so it was very strange for me at church that there literally wasn't a single example in the scriptures or in any depiction of, you know, when you go up and you say, what's a family? And they hand you a bowl. And I don't know, all of our roles came out of those things that pop up and scare you to death. That's just kind of what I grew up with, because she did work full time, but we were very happy. And that was a source of pride for me, and also something that I wanted, the college education, which I have, and I wanted to be able to support myself, and I found myself completely lacking in anything. So that was when I was young, so the scriptures, and then in the teenage years, and they pulled out Johnny Lingo, and that was, I mean, everyone kind of loved that, so they would play it multiple times a year in my ward, lucky us. And so in that, it's such a love, I don't know how many of you have seen that, but it's the ugly, Mahana, you ugly, and everyone treated this ugly girl as ugly, and they called her that until Johnny Lingo, the tradesman, shows up, and he says, oh, well, you know, if I buy her for an extreme amount of cows, that will raise her self-esteem when she talks to the people in town, and then she turns into, like, the beautiful girl with a flower in her hair and getting water for everyone happily. And at that point in time, I realized, I was like, well, now it's, I mean, before we were defined as the helpmate or the worrisome mother, and that's like, yay for these women, that was the role they played. And then in Johnny Lingo, in that depiction, and so many other Mormon depictions, it was the value that the man could bring to her was what she could tote around to all of her friends at the watering hole and stuff. And that kind of held true even on my mission. It was, this is the mission president and his wife. And I never knew her name, and she was very kind when my back hurt. But other than that, I mean, there was never a point in time that it was always the general authority and their wife. And I literally had friends that were aspiring to be the wife of some fancy general authority, and I don't even know how you aspire to that, because that, I don't know, I handle that myself. So so going into adulthood, then popular culture opened up a lot more for me, plus the internet came out and college and all of that. I was at BYU, and the I'm a Mormon campaign came out, and that was very, very new for me. I had never really seen Mormonism portrayed in greater media before. And the I'm a Mormon campaign was very surprising, because this was the first time in my life that these are women that I could relate to. And I mean, I'm not African American, but they had a very good, very few white people in the I'm a Mormon campaigns, and almost all of the women were working women. And I was like, wow, this is awesome. And yet I came home and I was like, that's still not it. Like, I mean, I'm glad that that's what we're presenting, but I feel so bad for anyone who thought that that's an accurate depiction. I mean, it still says in the Handbook of Instructions that women are only supposed to work in cases of emergency. And so if somebody's watching this and like, oh, I thought that, you know, Mormons were polygamists and wore hair and could only wear dresses, but look, they're totally normal people who work and are so diverse, and I will go to there, then you would show up and only to realize that you could come like that, but good luck staying like that. Or feeling a sense of pride, or your daughter growing up thinking that was the ideal. So, I don't know, that's kind of my experience, was for a really long time I couldn't even find a place for myself or the type of woman I wanted to be. And then when I finally did, it was a promo to get people to come. And that was because I still went to church, you know, at the time. And it was, I don't know. And I still have, I mean, they're making a lot of leaps and bounds. I think it's due to very brave women who have been vocal enough to point out the lack and the dichotomy of representation of women, but at the same time, many of them have been excommunicated for doing that or gained a very negative public appeal. And a really weird moment for me, I'll wrap up quickly, was 3 years ago, I had a friend ask me if I was a Mormon feminist. and she's not Mormon. And I looked at her, and I'm like, that's an oxymoron. But, I mean, and you have to define feminism. Like, I was so unfamiliar even with the term because it had such a negative connotation. I'm like, well, what does that mean to you? And she's like, well, it just means, I'm like, I don't think women are better than men, because that's what I thought it would mean. And she's like, no, it just means that you think you should have equal opportunities and the same access to the same things. And I was just like, it was very strange. At the time, I just wrote it off, and I said, oh, well, no, I mean, in Mormonism, it's like we work at jobs, and somebody works in publicists, and somebody works as a CEO, and they're both important, you know, and you don't need to know what marketing's doing if you're in, like, you know, writing or something, and that's cool, you know, and so those are our goals, and that's what makes it all work, and no one's better than anyone else. But then I went home, and I realized that I was pigeonholed. There was virtually no way that I could ever not be the one role that was given to me, and it, like, melted my brain, like, this one little question that she asked, and realizing what an oxymoron that would be, and it's very prevalent in pop culture, in the media, in our scriptures, of the lack of options for women was really my biggest takeaway. And it wasn't until I was even allowed to see that there are different ways to approach this. And it's not that you're wrong. I mean, you're wrong in some circles, but that I was able to really finally claim my own spot in Mormonism. And then I just have people tell me that that's still not accurate. I don't understand. It's on me. I don't understand my role. I don't understand how great it is. But I was a female missionary, and I've graduated from college, and I worked in a professional job. I feel like I have the credentials to know what it's like to be a woman in a very Mormon culture. And I don't know. I have high hopes for the future. So that's my experience. It's mostly a general lack at the beginning, and then when it came forward, it was unrealistic. It was not supported in the day-to-day life. So, thank you.
Good morning.
Good morning.
My name is Audrey Rock. I have, I think I have a little bit of a unique perspective here, because I've worked as a film critic. And I hadn't started actually working. I'd worked as a journalist beginning right at the cusp of Richard Dutcher's career. I hadn't begun working as a film critic when God's Army came out, which was March of 2000. I was working as a journalist, but they hadn't. I was working towards trying to convince them to make me a film critic, but I was working in Tooele, and they weren't convinced that that was something that was of value for their readers, for their readership. And by the time Brigham City came out, they were on board with me. But I followed basically that entire boom, and it was around 6 to 7 years, and basically, what I thought was interesting about God's Army was kind of the first female depiction that I saw in there was so positive to me. Even though we had male-centric, you know, very male-centric story, what Richard had was a female missionary who took these missionaries down and said, in this one scene, the will always remain indelible in my mind. These are my three favorite books: Anna Karenina, War and Peace, and Asher Lev. And none of these guys can keep up with her. And she basically leaves them speechless. And that always stood with me as an incredible example. And from then on out, it was kind of downhill, because with the Hailstorm films that followed, they just didn't really care whether or not they kept up with that. Their characters kind of just went straight into women that were just obviously just marriageable. They were just dating interests. They might have gone to BYU and they were looking for their education degrees, and whether or not they finished them didn't really matter. None of that followed through. They were very lovely girls, played by Brittany Bateman and Heather Beers, and you know, dating interests, and even worse, I'm sorry to say, but even worse, the mothers in these films are kind of pushy, they're kind of witchy, they're kind of just looking to get their daughters married off. They're looking to get their sons married off. And that was always highly discouraging to me. So watching that was, as a film critic, I just always felt like, where is the next Camille Franck? Where's the next Sister Franck who reads? Because Richard followed through with that all the way through God's Army to Sister Franck being an English major, finishing her degree, and in the end, you know, obviously they become married, and she's an educated woman with her college degree in English. And so, you know, even before meeting him, even pretty getting to know him and having the pleasure of being able to review his films, you know, watching his career come to full glory, you know, a lot of these films have already kind of destroyed this great view of women as being intelligent in the LDS Church. Recently, before I had a chance to even think all this all the way through, I had a conversation with Will Bagley about that I was going to be speaking on this. And Will Bagley, I'm sure a lot of you are familiar with him. He's a very prominent historian. He's no longer LDS, but I brought it up, and his immediate comment on this was, well, it's the Madonna effect. And and he's absolutely right, because right after kind of all this was a film called The Other Side of Heaven. And he's absolutely right. That immediately went into the Madonna effect. We had Anne Hathaway, who was the beautiful, untouchable woman at home, waiting for her missionary to come home. The Madonna effect. That's all she was. She was the Madonna. She was waiting for her missionary to come home. And it was very beautiful, and it was very lovely, but that's really all she was. There was really no strength to her character other than her being the Madonna. So we went straight into that. So there was no reality to her. There was no dimension to her. There was really no education to her. She was beautiful. She was lovely, but she was just simply meant to be the mother, the incubator, bringing the spirits into the world. That's really all we expected from Anne Hathaway's character. She was the other side of heaven. She was waiting for him on the other side of the world. Then we had, and this is, I know I shouldn't laugh, but we had this long-awaited central female character, which is Charlie. And Charlie is hardly original, because Charlie came around, I believe, maybe 1982, maybe even earlier in the 70s. Does anybody know?
Yeah, much older than that.
Much older than that?
At least early 70s.
So Charlie isn't even an original film character. Charlie was an adaptation. And so we brought Charlie to the screen. And Charlie is not the Madonna effect. The other comment that Will had made was that it was either the Madonna effect or the whore effect. And I hate to use that word, but that was exactly what he said. And if any of you are familiar with the story of Charlie, what's fascinating about Charlie is that Charlie comes into the central character's life, and he is looking for this perfect woman. He's looking for the perfect Madonna. But what he does instead is he falls in love with Charlie, who comes off of the plane directly from New York City with bare shoulders, which is which is shocking to him. And this return missionary is shocking to him. And she's very slinky. She's played by Heather Beers beautifully, by the way. She does a beautiful job with this performance. She's very snarky. She's very sort of funny, and which is not a Madonna character for what you'd expect in Mormonism. And she kind of corrupts him. She kind of makes him think a little outside of the box, which isn't necessarily a good thing. And he ends up finding that he doesn't really like her when he discovers that she has actually lived with a man for a while. And he decides that he doesn't really actually want to marry her. And so he goes through a time where he breaks up with her. And then he decides he has to do some soul searching. And ultimately he decides he's going to forgive. He's going to bestow his forgiveness upon Charlie. He then falls in love with Charlie again, in spite of the fact that she has been so sinful. And she becomes baptized. She marries him. And within a couple of years, she has one very small child. I think the child is probably only about 2 years old before she develops cancer and dies. So, Charlie, ultimately, if you think about it, Charlie really pays for her whoredoms and her horrible life. And I really sort of take exception with that because she's really not a strong female LDS character. She's really just somebody who, you know, as Will says, she's just sort of the Madonna slash whore effect. She comes into his life. She gets a few years of glory and happiness because she changed her life, but she didn't really live her life from the beginning, born in the covenant, being a good woman. And so I think that's sort of a sad commentary on she's really the only one strong LDS character we've had in Mormon popular culture. And strangely enough, it was really quite popular. I mean, we had a lot of people go see Charlie. We had a ton read the book. I mean, I remember even, and I was, you know, I graduated in 94. Even still, people were passing that book around through my high school and reading it and crying. I read it when I was like 12 years old, and I remember thinking, this is crap. I was an English major, and I was, you know, way ahead of my level of reading at a very young age. My dad had read to me a lot, and I just remember thinking, what is this crap? And when the movie came out, I was impressed with Heather Beer's performance. I was impressed with some elements of the film, but I just felt like this is not, we have got to be able to do better, you know, than what we have here. The one other strong female character that we have, other than, you know, obviously we had, in the meantime, we had Hailstorm and some of these other films continue. We had The Best 2 Years, which was, you know, pretty good. But again, no females anywhere to be spoken of. The other one we had was Pride and Prejudice, which is, again, an adaptation. We didn't have anything original. Nobody decided to come out and say, let's find a good original female role for a woman. And Pride and Prejudice is, once again, it's so archaic. It's so, let's just take another woman that needs to be married and put her in Mormon LDS culture. And obviously we know the story of Pride and Prejudice, which is just a woman who needs to find a husband. So for me, just watching this entire LDS boom from beginning to end, which to me the end was Church Ball. I remember watching Church Ball and saying, okay, I'm done. There were a few, you know, kind of trailed off, and there were a few, and I was kind of at the end of my career as a film critic at that time, and I just remember giving up and saying, there aren't going to be any original female characters in the LDS film. And so it's been a discouraging odyssey. And so I don't think that necessarily what we need to be seeing is strong feminist female characters in LDS film. They don't have to be strong. They don't have to be impenetrable. They don't have to be professors. They don't have to be doctors. They just need to be female characters. Why aren't we seeing them? I don't really necessarily know. Richard has an announcement about a film that I have written for the screen, and we'll be talking a little bit more about that. But I do think it's a really fascinating discussion that has needed to be explored for a long time, and I think it's taken too long for us to get here. So I'm not sure that I've really been able to talk to everything I want to discuss, but there's really not enough time. I've probably taken too much, but I really appreciate your time, and I'm glad everybody's been able to be here to join us today. Thank you.
I hope, does this work? I'm not hearing anything.
Good.
Okay, I like to move when I talk. Also, I just had a big thing of coffee, so I got to move. So it's time for the seventh inning stretch. So everybody stand up. Come on. Seventh inning stretch is brought to you by States of Grace, which all of you should have gotten for free when you registered. So if you didn't, go grab your coffee, and I'll sign it for you. Come to my table. Okay, I'm going to talk fast because I got a lot to say. But usually when I announce a film, I do it in a different circumstance, and usually there's more people. But I decided that my next film is called She's Not Herself. And this is the reason we're talking about it today, is because it has to do with the subject. And because this is the strongest female character Mormon character you will ever see. And I'm pretty excited about it. And let me tell you how this came about. For me, just in general, when I was in a Western class in college, we were talking about, you know, women in Westerns. And in Westerns, I don't know if you're aware, you know, women are either the whore or they're the school teacher or a mother. School teacher, mother character, and that's it, you know.
Barbie.
What's that?
Maddie Ross.
Oh, don't give me the exceptions. All right, and when we put this thing together and we started talking, and Audrey and I started talking about the women, and we did miss talking about Errand of Angels. That's a movie that has some female characters in it, but it's not really worth talking about too much. But the sad thing was, is when we started talking about a panel about this, that all of us, I think, kind of said, what do we talk about? You know, there's not enough depictions of women in LDS popular culture, and once you pretty much say, you know, here's the mothers and here's some missionaries, and that's about it. And that really, really is a sad thing that there hasn't been a more full and a more broad depiction, at least in movies. In literature, we have, you know, quite a bit more, but it's about time to change that. And it's interesting. After I made God's Army, I had a lot of women come to me and say, you know, I'd like to tell a story about the LDS, you know, female perspective and what it's like to be an LDS mother and a wife and in reality, you know, the real thing. And I would always say, well, that's great. They always wanted me to write it, you know, they wanted me to make it. And I said, well, I'm not an LDS woman. And I really think you should go make that, and I'm, you know, totally supportive and go do it. You know, let's see that. I want to see a lot more of that. You know, I'd love to see that movie, but not being an LDS woman, I don't think I can make it. And I said that, you know, to several women, some of them may be here today, and felt that way, but I never saw anything, and that's why when Errand of Angels was coming out, I was pretty excited about it because I thought, oh, great, here's a kind of a God's Army with women in it. And I was a little disappointed because the main character was kind of stupid and it, you know, didn't, to me, it, the German chick, the German lady, she was, I loved her. She was an interesting character. I'd like to see a whole movie about her. But I kept feeling that thing missing. And then when Audrey and I started seeing each other, she mentioned this book called The Awakening and how much she loved it. And so we went to Barnes & Noble and picked up a copy, and I read it, and I just thought, oh, this is fantastic. And she said, I've always wanted, you know, I thought maybe this would be a great movie, and started talking about the possibility of bringing it into a Mormon context. And I said, that's a fantastic idea. How many of you have read The Awakening, by the way? Oh, such a beautiful and powerful story. And the thing that was immediately apparent to me and became more apparent as Audrey was working on the screenplay, by the way, it's a killer screenplay, but it was shocking how taking this book that was published in, what, 1910, 1911?
1899.
1899?
Yeah,
I think great. I can count on Holly to correct every damn thing I say. 1899. And how you take that and bring it, you know, 115 years into the future and put it in the Mormon context, and there's not a lot to change. And that is just kind of shocking, you know? And but at the same time, exciting, because when she brought me the first draft of the screenplay, I had an opposite reaction. Instead of saying, yeah, you know, I expected to say, yeah, go make that. She gave me the screenplay, and I read it, and I was like, I'm directing this. I'm making this. Because it's so powerful. And what Audrey was done, especially in the first draft, it was interesting because in my drafts of God's Army, I had the first drafts weren't very good. There was, you know, and some people argue the last drafts weren't very good either, but it wasn't until I put my own self into it that it actually became something, you know. So I suddenly, you know, brought my own experiences, my own family and childhood experiences and missionary experiences into it. Then it became something worthwhile. And what Audrey's done, which is just fantastic, is she's brought her experience as a modern Mormon, frustrated Mormon woman and mother into this story. So she's brought her own, you know, those feelings, and those perceptions, and those, you know, the things that women see and experience and hear every day that men don't, you know. And so I'm super excited about this project, and the reason I wanted to announce it here at Sunstone was because making a film is very difficult. You've got to start, you've got to find, you've got to pull in all this money and the support, and you've got to just, you know, there's so much demanded in order to get it done. So I want you to help me get this movie made because it's important. It's absolutely important, and this is going to be a little bit of a bombshell in our community, because it's finally going to say, because, you know, I'm not afraid of what the general authorities are going to say or what they feel about it, and I just want to say, look, I just want to poke them in the eye a bit and say, you know, this is a real perspective. This is what's happening. This is how a lot of women feel, and this is what a lot of men recognize, and it's time that we started having this conversation, you know, out loud. And sometimes women feel so discouraged and so controlled and so, you know, that other people are living their lives that they just want to walk into the ocean and drown themselves, you know? This movie's going to be so awesome. But anyway, so come to our table. I'm at number 9 down there. Come get your copy of States of Grace if you haven't. But come talk and grab Audrey and talk about the movie. And we need to get... I kind of dragged Audrey into this Sunstone community because... you know, she was a, you know, faithful LDS mother and wife for so long, and then she got caught up with a guy like me. So, but I want her to know you, especially those of you who are strong in the LDS women's communities and movements. And I want her to know you and be a part of and work with you to get this film made, because we're going to need your support and your perspective and your feedback. And hopefully next year at this time, when we do a Sunstone, we'll be able to show you, if not a final cut of the movie, at least a cut, and get your perspective on what we've done. So next year, instead of having a panel where we're all sitting around saying, what the hell did we talk about? Instead, we've got something very exciting to talk about. Great. Thank you. Let's open it up for questions.
Thank you.
Holly, what a surprise.
I know. So, The Other Side of Heaven was also an adaptation. It was a memoir before. And actually, if you do want to find, you, Richard, mentioned that there are interesting Mormon women more in literature. And frankly, if you really want to find Mormon women in the arts, you go to memoir, not so much novels. Though that's starting to change, and just so you know, we have two really, really interesting novelists back there. They're both British. They're Jen Ashworth and Kara Spray, and they are doing really interesting work with Mormon women. I do want to say one more thing about God's Army. One of the things that I thought was most interesting and that I liked best with what you did with women in there is that you made the mission president's wife an interesting, sexy person. Your character flirted with her, had a crush on her. And she was not just, you know, as she aged, she just didn't disappear into irrelevance.
Yeah, they actually had an affair, but I cut that part out.
Okay. The other thing I want to say about God's Army is, yes, the younger sister missionary was interesting, but I couldn't help noticing how she ended up. The main character, and I remember this very well because I was a grad student in English at the time, the main character walks into a freshman composition class. She's his teacher. They start dating. They get engaged, if not married, before the semester is over, which would get you fired most places. And the movie ends with him sitting in an armchair and her bringing him a hot, soothing beverage and sitting down at his feet. And so even still, it's you know, I think that if you really want to understand Mormon women, what you need to read is the short story, The Whore of Mensa by Woody Allen, which is about, the real dichotomy for Mormon women is not so much Madonna whore, but intellectual baby machine, or smart chick, hot chick. And Whore of Mensa is about the frustration men face when they marry a girl who's cute, and then that's all she is. She goes off and she writes mommy blogs, and she doesn't make him feel smart. And the Whore of Mensa, one of the things, it's, you know, Woody Allen in the late 60s, early 70s, so you can, you would pay for intellectual experiences, like, for instance, listening to FM radio with twins, having a woman get in a fight with you over Freud's conception of women, going to the MoMA and stuff like that. So, and at that moment, what that character becomes is not so much the smart chick. She becomes the one who still is in service to him. Mm-hmm.
So, Holly, your comment leads into mine. I sometimes tell my students that the only thing worse than being a sex object is not being a sex object. And I think that it's very true that this is sort of a tension in the depictions of Mormon women. It's like, how do you portray sexuality in a healthy way that, you know, neither makes women, you know, this commercial sex object, but also, I think even worse sometimes, is this invisible, unsexed woman who is equally boring and awful or something. It's, you know, it's like we have these, you know, false dichotomies or something. So how do you portray, you know, a woman who is, you know, a lot of things, but certainly you don't want to erase her sexuality either. So I think that's a real challenge in Mormon culture, but also in Mormon arts in general. You know, trying to deal with sexuality, you know, not being afraid of it, but not being also, you know, oh, we have to have these other kind of stereotypes. So anyway, I don't know if anybody has comments on that. Maybe you'll deal with that one.
Yeah, we're not going to have a problem with that in The Awakening. And that's kind of a central theme. There's definitely a a theme of sexual awakening with that, so it's going to be very strong.
Good.
And it'll actually be a rated R film, probably the closest to Falling since, well, obviously, I'm not even sure if there's been a rated R film since Falling that was Mormon-themed. So it deals with, it actually does deal with her sexual awakening.
Mm-hmm.
With the central character's sexual awakening, so.
Great panel, by the way. Question for Richard. As Mormons, we tend to follow general culture 20 years or 30 years behind. It seems to me, as I've kind of gone through my feminist awakening in the last year or so, that I see, it looks like to me, in general culture, that trend is happening, although still there's a long way to go of giving women more powerful roles and stuff like that. I'm wondering your thoughts on that. Do you see that happening, and to what level?
Yeah, I think that's a good point. I mean, you can't. First of all, let me address one of the reasons I want to make this film is because I recognize it. And I mean, when I started telling my stories, I was, you know, they're very male-centric stories. I was telling my story. My story hadn't been told. So I look back on it now, and I wish I'd done more with the mission president's wife. I wish I'd done more with the sister missionaries. You know, I wish I'd. But you know, there's a gradual awakening that everybody has. You know, but in general. And I want to correct that. You know, I want to come in strong, and I want to make a movie that it's going to be hard to top. You know, and it'll be something that'll be applicable for every Mormon woman. I definitely want to talk about. You know, because boy, there's a lot to talk about. But in general, yeah. I mean, you know, depictions of women. I mean, women are mothers. You know, women are sometimes whores, and women are everything. You know, just like men are everything, and so it's exciting. It's exciting when you have complex characters, and I think that's one of the things that one of the reasons that the depictions of women in LDS media, visual media, has been so shitty is simply because the filmmakers have been so shitty,
yes.
And so they don't understand the complexity. You know, I mean, they can't portray a complex man, so how are they going to portray a complex woman? You know, they can't portray a complex human being in any way, and so I think that's where I mean, you see it in, as you pointed out, you know, in mass culture, in popular culture, you know, you see a lot of, you just don't pay any attention to it, you know. It's like, well, those are all one-dimensional characters, and who cares, and you just don't even think about it. But then you see something exciting, like, what's a good movie in the past year, like Jennifer Lawrence movie set in the 70s?
American Hustle.
Yeah, American Hustle, you know, what a great character, you know. I mean, she was so complex, and she was all over the man. You couldn't take your eyes off of her, and you know, she's a wife and she's a mother, but holy cow, you know. I mean, what a wife and what a mother. And that's what, you know, it would be great when LDS culture kind of catches up a bit to that, and so we can see some complexity. The problem, of course, is fundamental problem is if in the culture, you know, women aren't acknowledged as complex and aren't valued except as mothers and wives, then yeah, you got a problem. So that's where there's going to be a clash, and that's where I think this movie can provide something really valuable. This story. So if you haven't read The Awakening, go read it and think about it in a modern Mormon context, and you'll see what I'm talking about. So it's going to make a difference.
My personal favorite is Brigham City. Those are real people and real Mormonism. So, but I would like to change the conversation just a bit and ask Micah, as a wedding photographer, what you get is real people in their only chance to be pop culture. They're displaying themselves. Is there a difference between Mormon pictures and non-Mormon pictures? And are Mormon pictures changing?
That's an interesting question. So, like most Mormon wedding photographers, you start off shooting a lot of Mormon weddings for like $200 or $300, you know, and because anything more than that, most Mormon weddings, that it's just not in the budget. And so, I actually photograph with my wife. She's actually my art director, and so she, you know, poses our brides and grooms and makes sure that everything that they look their best. And You know, I'm more of the technician, and then she does all of our post-production. But anyway, after we started having some success, then we sort of broadened outside of the Mormon wedding market. And it is a fascinating difference where you do see, in my experience, you do see Mormon brides sort of wanting, they want their photos to look like the photos that they see in the bridal magazines. They want them to be, you know, high fashion, high art, trendy, popular stuff that you see on Pinterest. And so they, you know, and I think this is true for Mormon pop culture in general. You're always sort of shadowing the mainstream, but also trying to remain unique and to remain peculiar, you know. You know, in terms of, you know, for example, since most of these couples, these Mormon couples, have never had sex with each other, as opposed to the non-Mormon weddings that we shoot, it's just a very different interaction that you have with the two kinds of couples. So, for example, when I ask a Mormon couple, get close to each other, you know, it's just like this hesitation where if you have people who have been courting each other for 5 years and live with each other and sometimes have already had kids with each other and they've started families, to see them connect in front of the camera is a very different scenario than when you've got kids in their early 20s that, you know, haven't really experienced life yet. And so that's probably the biggest difference that I see between, you know, photographing Mormon couples and non-Mormon couples. But it's still interesting to see, you know, a Mormon bride, they still want their wedding to look like, you know, a normal wedding, even though, and it's just so interesting how little of the day centers around the temple, you know. Most of the wedding planning is still about, and that's why I'm really excited if the rumors are true that the church is going to get rid of its 1 year waiting period for the civil ceremonies, because I think a lot of Mormon women are going to be able to finally own that part of wedding culture. And so I don't know, it's going to be kind of interesting to see how that affects things. I don't know if I answered your question, but we kind of riffed on there for a minute. Sorry about that.
Piggyback on Margaret's comment, I would be really interested in seeing a movie about a Bill Spafford type, the big hair Mormon administrator who later in life discovers her sexuality. Now that would be a movie I'd go to see.
We'll make that one.
Yeah. Give us a few years. That would be some awakening.
Thank you very much for your presentation. I just can't help but connect with your words when you said that, you know, being Mormon and being a feminist is quite an awkward blend. Let's say it for what it is. And I did my graduate studies about 6 years ago on Mormon feminist women, and it became very apparent to me that there is. When I was talking to my feminist friends, they were just, the reaction was either how or what, or I feel sorry for you, or, I mean, it just, I didn't really feel welcomed over there, and I also didn't feel welcomed in my Mormon world. And I see that you're trying to marry the two and show that and portray that in the media, but is that ever really going to change, that people... Are people ever really going to see Mormon feminists as true feminists or true Mormons? And how can you... I would love to hear some of your thoughts about how you can kind of marry the two and have people take you seriously.
Thank you. I love your question. For me, the fact that question was... My friend asked me 3 years ago, are you a Mormon feminist? And I mean, even the question, I couldn't even wrap my head around. And I was always an outlier in Mormonism and more progressive. But that, I mean, the term was almost offensive to me being asked. And now I'm a very outspoken feminist and even was given an invitation to a court of love for being a feminist. So that's 3 years for me. Less than three. I mean, that question was asked to me, and it's really only been in the last 2 years. And I have been really shocked at how, if people are just willing to have the conversation, to even ask you, what does that mean? Or what does that mean to you? Or, I mean, God bless Kate Kelly for allowing us to even have that conversation again. And, I mean, just so many people have just, the ones that are self-confident enough to ask me anyway, just saying like, okay, so you support her, but she seems completely crazy and she's teaching her own doctrine and this. And it's just been such a beautiful opportunity to see that she's not teaching her own doctrine. She's teaching Mormon doctrine and showing that there's precedence there. And the second that conversation happens, all of us girls grew up being, I don't know, I can't say all. I'll say the majority and the girls I hang out with. We're very, you know, we all wanted to do the cool things that the Boy Scouts did. We all thought our activities were lame growing up. We all lacked, you know, a potential and a place to be. But because there was virtually nowhere to voice that and no potential to change it, we just accepted that God liked boys more. And we had to be excited about that. And now I think just the second that conversation comes up, you see all these women turn from, oh, that's not me, feminist, blah. Being like, oh my gosh, no, I absolutely relate with that, and I, you know, I don't support Kay Kelly because you get in trouble for that, but I, you know, they automatically start being so much more supportive and saying, I relate with that, I have those feelings too, just don't call me a feminist, but they feel it. So in response to that, I really think it's changing much more quickly than any other type, in my opinion.
And we have to wrap it up. But the last point I want to make about this is, I think, you know, in telling these stories, which we have to start telling these stories, whether you want to call it feminism, Mormon feminism, or whatever, to me it's just like, look at the, you know, we've got to start hearing these voices, and people have to start recognizing these stories. And in the, taking a quote out of the book, The Awakening, when the husband goes to complain about his wife and what's going on with her, she's not herself, and blah, blah, blah. And the great character just asked her, what are you doing to her? And I think that's the question we need to... People have to start realizing, what are we doing to Mormon women? You know, what is our culture doing to Mormon women? And once we start waking up to that and hearing their voices and hearing their stories, then we've grown up a little bit more as a culture. So great. Thank you for coming.